It's still sort of related to incoherent metals, but now I'm going to talk about iron completeness instead. And it's very much a work in progress, so I'd be very happy to hear your feedback. It's not nearly as polished as some of the other things we've heard, but anyways, and it's sort of primarily come out of conversations with John McGreevy and Senthil. And actually, we first mentioned this idea in a paper a few years ago, talking about crossovers between thermodynamic entropy and entanglement entropy. So let me just begin with an introduction, and let's start at a familiar place, which is the renormalization group. Right? So if we want to understand emergence in complex systems, one very powerful tool is to ask how things look at long wavelengths. That's what you sort of mean by emergence. And the renormalization group provides a way to organize your thinking about that subject. You start with some microscopic model in the ultraviolet, and this is sort of high energy, low energy, or short distance, long distance. And you, as you flow down, as you go from high energy to low energy, the Hamiltonian, defined at some particular energy scale, moves around the space of couplings. Right? And so you can have various things. For example, you could have a fixed point where all the directions go in, or you can have a fixed point with some unstable directions and some stable directions. And as we all know, this leads to a very nice geometrical picture of phases and phase transitions. Right? So phases are associated with attractive fixed points where everything flows to that point. So everything in this phase, even this region, was one thing because at long wavelengths, it always goes to this one point. And similarly, you have this point with one relevant direction, one direction that flows away, then that's a transition. Because if you're tuned to this line, then you go to the point. But if you tune away, then you flow to a phase on either side. So this is a nice geometrical picture of phases and phase transitions. And this leads immediately to a certain concept, a very important concept, which is the concept of being UV incomplete, which I like to say as if you only have access to low energy measurements and you can't measure arbitrarily precise for arbitrarily long, then you can't know the details of the high energy theory. Right, you just don't have access to that physics. And so you say, you know, you have a low energy description, it has to be UV completed to give you a complete microscopic description of the system. So again, the idea is we make low energy measurements. We don't make high energy measurements, at least not in, let's say, the context of high energy physics, which is kind of funny. It should be called low energy physics. And condensed matter should be called high energy physics.
That's true.
and cold atoms should be called hot atoms because they're hot compared to the standard scale. So it's all backwards. But I would say there's a wrinkle in this, which is maybe in principle harmless, but maybe not, which is that we don't really do low energy measurements. We would do medium energy measurements, right? So we can do measurements low compared to the bare scales in the microscopic Hamiltonian, but there could be an emergent length scale or time scale, which we're not able to probe in our medium energy measurements, right? And so it's conceivable that measurements at medium energies are insufficient to determine what the infrared of the theory is going to do, right? So this is very different from, you know, saying you're at very low temperatures in a topological state where you sort of know where you're going. This is like somehow saying you really have a lot of uncertainty at the energy scales that you can probe about what the infrared physics is going to look like. And so we could call that IR incomplete. And what I want to convince you is that this is an interesting concept to think about, and it helps us understand or make sense of some non-trivial examples coming from holographic duality and also possibly examples from condensed matter physics. Okay, so let's talk about holographic duality. So this is our cartoon. Holographic duality is a secret where sometimes theories of particles are secretly the same as theories of gravity in one more dimension. So the particles you can think of as the red stuff, they live on this kind of crust of this cylinder, and the gravity lives in the blue interior. And there's a nice dictionary which relates degrees of freedom on one side to the other side. So it's not like you have a system with a bulk and an edge. It's you have the field theory, and it's just exactly the same thing as the gravity. They're not living in the same place. They're just equivalent descriptions of the same physics. And so one entry in this dictionary is that, you know, the field theory is defined on some non-dynamical d plus one dimensional space-time, right? and it contains only non-gravitational degrees of freedom, at least in the simplest version. Whereas the gravity is defined on a d plus two-dimensional space-time, which is dynamical. So that's the blue. The blue can fluctuate. And one entry in the dictionary is that the boundary of the blue part should be the red part, or the conformal boundary, to be more precise. Okay. And, you know, there's a dictionary, which at some level maybe say it is the partition functions are just equal, as long as I know what I mean by these sources J. In one case, it's couplings of operators in the field theory. In another case, it's boundary values of fields, right? So they have a bulk field which goes to some boundary value. And the partition function is just supposed to be equal. And there's some interesting, you know, points here. You know, one is that this emergent direction is somehow associated with renormalization in the field theory. It's an old, well-known observation. And also, there's a conservation of evil, as John McGreevy likes to say, which is that you can't usually tell, you know, one is hard to solve and the other one is easy to solve. So it's not obviously wrong, even though the Ising model doesn't obviously have a quantum gravitational theory inside it, although it secretly does. So let's talk about a particular example. So here's a kind of thing that people in this business do. They write down a bulk action. So here's a metric. There's a gravitational part. We have a gauge field in the bulk. So there's a gauge field kinetic term. Let's say we may have a fermion, which is a probe fermion. And what this means is that this theory, you should think of this bulk theory, means that I'm describing secretly a conformal field theory, or I'm taking into account a certain set of operators. And those operators include the metric. I mean, it includes the stress tensor of the field theory, right? So this is what's related to the metric. It includes some conserved current, which is related to the gauge field, and some fermionic field, which is related to the probe fermion. Right? And so if I solve this theory, if I find solutions to this theory, then I understand properties of the dual CFT. And in particular, we want to study finite density CFTs. So you take a CFT and you add a chemical potential for this conserved current. So you have a finite amount of stuff. And you can look for solutions, you know, look like this, which have the following structure. You start out with some, I'm going to specialize to the case of one dimension, because it's particularly interesting for me. You have an ADS3 up here, right? So that's like the high energy short distance physics, where it just looks conformal. But then you have stuff, so if you look at long enough wavelengths, you see the effect of the stuff, right, the matter. And then the fact that there's stuff is encoded in the fact that there's an electric field which points, you know, which sort of is sourced by this, you know, deep inside the geometry. That tells you that there's some stuff in the boundary. And what you find is that there's a very simple solution. If I ignore the fermion, if I just solve this theory at finite density, there's a very simple solution where I start with an ADS3, and I go to something which is called ADS2, times, in this case, R. Right? And what this ADS2 is, it's sort of like, if this is dual to a CFT with one space and one time dimension, then this is dual to a CFT with zero space and one time dimension. So it's somehow like critical quantum mechanics. And this is what the metric looks like. So it has kind of this ADS part here, where time and the radial coordinate are still involved in some way. But the spatial part is just dropped out. It's just coming along for the ride. Okay, now why is this thing weird? Well, it has some strange properties. The first is that if you take the limit of zero temperature, you find that there remains an extensive ground state entropy. Right? So somehow the system is not selecting a single unique ground state as you cool it down. There's a massive local degeneracy in what you can have. Secondly, you have short-range spatial correlations. So there's some correlation link, which sort of fits with this picture of, you know, you have local degrees of freedom, but they're not talking to each other. But you have algebraic and time correlations. So this, you know, may remind you of any number of systems from condensed matter physics. But I want to convince you that first of all, this sort of system should be thought of as an IR incomplete system, according to a definition I'll give you later, and that we have other systems in condensed matter physics which mimic this physics. And so then we have a group of systems with some interesting, you know, new kind of emergent properties, and we can study those properties.
Okay. Is psi a fermion, or does it matter?
It could be a scalar too, but yeah, let's just say it's a fermion. Yeah.
What about if it's energy momentum tensor? Does this still hold?
The energy momentum tensor.
Or current?
Yeah, so the current, it still holds. Although the dimension in the case of the current, so here this dimension can be fractional or weird, but for the current, it's just dimension 2. So it's relatively simple.
So do you understand these things are averaged over all the ground states?
Sorry?
So these are averaged over all the ground states.
Well, so this is an important point, is that you can argue that it's not like entanglement or something like that. It's really just a classical incoherent mixture of ground states you don't know what they are. Right? So it's not there's a lot of entanglement, it's just an incoherent mixture. And the other thing which I want to draw your attention to is that actually it's not just a pure power law, because these dimensions actually depend on momentum. So if I look at some plane wave operator of this fermion and I look at its temporal correlations, they depend on what the momentum is. So this is a sort of a little bit subtle. It's not like I just have completely disconnected little localized things that are critical. Somehow there's some remembrance of the fact that these things are patched together in the form of this k-dependent operator dimension. And in fact, what you do if you look at the spatial correlations, equal space temporal correlations, you get this extra logarithmic piece, which kind of gets tagged along. So I want you to remember this.
Yeah, it's mentioned that this stuff that infinite U Hubbard model is the degree with a gap in it.
Yeah, so just wait. Yeah, just wait. Okay, so I'd like to understand what this is. Let's say that's my goal, is to understand what this ADS2 region really is. Okay, so enter another very different system called the spin incoherent Langer liquid. And I want to convince you, I want to tell you what the system is and then convince you that it has very similar properties to this ADS2. So let's think about the following simple setup. I have one-dimensional fermions. They carry spin, and they're at very strong coupling, and they interact with some Coulomb interaction like this. And what strong coupling means in this language is I have a density of fermions here, and I have some natural scale set by the strength of the Coulomb interaction. And strong coupling or low density means that the particles are much farther apart than this natural scale. Right. So the interaction is really strong, or they're really dilute. Okay. So this is the setup. And you might think a natural thing for the system to do in this situation is to form a crystal. But of course, in one dimension, you can't quite form a crystal because you can't break this translation symmetry. So it's sort of almost a crystal, but not quite. But a useful starting point is to sort of think of it as a crystal, a quasi-long-range crystal, and proceed from there. So we have sort of almost long-range ordered positions of our electrons, and the spins can then do some fluctuation. So what is that spin physics? Well, it turns out that if you look at the spin problem, then you find something very interesting. At strong coupling, you can imagine doing the following thing. Let's just fix all but two of the electrons right next to each other, and then study that two-electron problem with all the rest of the particles fixed. Right? And if we go to a radial coordinate, a relative coordinate, then basically what you can say is you can have electrons here or there. Right? And it's a double well potential because they can't sit on top of each other. There's a strong repulsion. And so you sort of classically you would have, either they sit here in this wave function or they sit here in this wave function. But when you include tunneling, what happens is these two guys can mix. Right, so you can get symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations. But at very strong coupling, when these guys are really far apart, that tunneling is heavily suppressed. In fact, it's exponentially small in a certain parameter. And since the effective spin interaction is controlled by whether you're in the symmetric or anti-symmetric wave function, right? Whether you're a spin singlet or a spin triplet determines what your spatial wave function looks like, then this translates into an effective Heisenberg exchange. But where the size of this exchange is very small. Okay. In fact, this kind of stuff was first discussed by Ballas years ago in the context of Heisenberg exchange and solid helium 3. So, you know, there's a long and very beautiful history of calculating these things in one and higher dimensions. Okay. So what does this give us? Well, I said we starting from this Wigner crystal picture, this almost Wigner crystal. So I have phonons of the almost Wigner crystal, which is like the charge degree of freedom. And then I have a spin sector, so that has some energy scale E charge. And I have a spin sector, which if you do the calculations, you find sort of goes to zero exponentially fast with this RS parameter, or with the square root of RS. And you know, following this picture of an almost static lattice, I can say this is more or less like a Heisenberg model with some very small, potentially very small J, if I'm at very large RS. Okay. So let's first remind ourselves what happens if I'm not at very large RS. I'm just at some intermediate coupling, so I'm not at super low density. Then I get this Luttinger liquid physics. So I have the charge degree of freedom here, and I have the spin degree of freedom, I have some entanglement, I have correlation functions that are all parallel decaying. Everything looks sort of similar. You know, everything looks familiar from Luttinger liquids. But the interesting thing now is that very naturally, just by taking the density to be very dilute, I can reach a regime where the following thing happens, where the charge energy is much, much bigger than the spin energy. And in principle, I could take the temperature and I could put it in between those two energy scales. Right? And I think this regime was first, was really talked about, as far as I know, first by Matveev, and then there was some very beautiful Beta Ansatz work, and then what really inspired me was nice work by Feith and Balintz, where they give a very simple picture, which I'll give you in a second, of how to understand the physics of this state of matter. But just to reiterate, I have this separation of scales very naturally, right? Where I have charge energy and I have spin energy, and the spin energy can be really small. And so I can put the temperature in between them, and in particular, I could consider a limit where J goes to zero first, and then T goes to zero, and I'm left with some kind of zero temperature state where I have sort of more or less ordinary charge physics, Luttinger liquid charge physics, but the Hamiltonian for the spins is just zero. So it's as if they're completely incoherent. And so the first thing to note is that this obviously has a ground state entropy, just from the thermal mixing of these incoherent spin degrees of freedom. And that entropy will be extensive in system size, and just related to whether or not you can occupy, these fermionic states. They're sort of maximally mixed. Okay. And then the second thing is that if you look now at correlations of electrons, so not just the charge degrees of freedom, but the physical particles, you should expect something weird to happen, because what you've got now is you've got to add charge and spin, right? An electron is both charge and spin. The charge is sort of conventional, but the spin is incoherent. It's completely mixed. So somehow it should be hard to do this. And indeed, what you find is if you look at this correlator, now there are several new pieces. There's, in particular, a new exponential decay, which is set by KF, and also by how many spin components you have. Here I'm just doing spin a half. And the power laws are all changed. So it looks very different from the Luttinger liquid physics. But in particular, if you put x equal to 0, it's still power law in time, whereas it's exponentially decaying in space. And so just in how do you understand this physics? This is an extremely beautiful picture, I think, which is the following picture. So remember, we had our particles, and we already said that tunneling is suppressed, right? Because there's this really strong Coulomb repulsion. Particles can't go through each other. That's why there was no exchange, or the exchange was very small. So then I can think in a world line picture of my particles following Feith and Balintz. And I can say the following, I have various classes of trajectories. If I want to add a particle here and take one away there, then one thing that could happen is that I could have some particles that are more or less unperturbed, and I could have particles that wind around the imaginary time direction like this. So this, let me call a winding trajectory. Another possibility is you could have what you could call a displacing trajectory, where they don't wind, but they push all the other particles really far out of the way. All the particles in between them have to get pushed because they can't cross them. Tunneling is suppressed. They have to be pushed out of the way. And now it seems pretty reasonable that within this no-crossing approximation, this configuration is very heavily favored compared to this one. You know, you're not making any drastic modifications to your world lines in this picture. And so these guys proposed a very beautiful formula based on dropping all the displacing terms. So just ignore these. And what you get is something very nice. You say that the Green's function is a product of several pieces. First, there is a sort of fermion sign associated with a number of world lines in between where you're adding your particle and where you're taking your particle out. Right? The second is just a simple exponential suppression of the same number of world lines, just because of a very simple reason that this particle, which goes here and comes out and keeps going, has to have the same spin all along this line. Right? So the spin has to be the same everywhere. Because there are no spin flips. Right? There's no spin dynamics at all. So of all possible trajectories, only ones where all these lines have the same spin contribute to this correlation function. And so that just introduces a 1/2 to the number of lines you have to set equal. And then there's the charge physics, where I just have to add and remove the charge degree of freedom. Right? And I want to emphasize this number of world lines fluctuates in principle. But the number of world lines is, again, related to the charge physics. Right? It's just a number. It's, roughly speaking, the fluctuating number of particles in between your two points. So everything in this formula refers only to the charge physics. The spin physics enters only in specifying that it's spin half, so I have a 2 here. If it was spin s, it would be 2s plus 1 to the end. And so you can kind of see immediately where, for example, this exponential decay comes from. This is just the average number of particles between 0 and x. And so you get an exponential decay. The log 2 is spin half, and these pi's come from the definition of the density in terms of kf.
Are there subtleties in real time?
In principle, there are. So the assumption, so if you really set j to 0, then maybe it's okay. But if you say j is non-trivial, t is above j, and I want to do some short time dynamics on the scale of j, then there could be an issue. But let me just assume that j is actually just 0. And I think in principle, there is something non-trivial about the dynamics. So here I'm just doing everything in imaginary time, it's sort of equilibrium to some extent, and I'm ignoring this subtlety. Okay. So this is the physics of this spin incoherent state. And to conclude, let me just point out two things. Again, the entropy, this Gramsci entropy, is extensive and it's classical. It's just associated with the fluctuating unconstrained spins. It's not entanglement. There is some entanglement left over from the charge degrees of freedom, but it's not entanglement in terms of this extensive entropy. And the second thing is that if you look closely at the correlation function for equal space and unequal times, you find that not only does it have a parallel, it again has a square root log dependence, which is exactly what you found in the ADS2 case. So this spin-incoherent Schrödinger liquid looks an awful lot like, in terms of its correlation functions and entropy, the ADS2 region in the case of one spatial dimension. So let me take these two examples and try to draw some kind of general lesson.
I mean, if you were finite for very small j, and you yes. have a finite energy density state,
yes.
corresponding to sort of finite temperature, it would presumably have a volume entanglement. I mean, you're doing some sort of classical averaging over
a yes, that's what I'm doing a classical average.
No entanglement, but it's really there. You're just averaging over.
Well, I mean, I think it depends on what state you're doing, right?
I'm
choosing a particular state here, which is this incoherent mixture of.
You're right, but that's not really a quantum state. You're just doing some classical averaging.
Yeah.
I
completely agree with you. But my goal is not to study the quantum state. My goal is to see if this thing is related to this ADS2. That's what I'm aiming at. So I completely agree that in principle we could study different states, like a pure state where J is very small and the dynamics and see what happens. That would be very interesting. But here I'm going to study this mixed state. Okay, that's what I'm restricting myself to. Okay. So what's the intuition then for this IR incompleteness? The idea is, you know, if we have these, you know, this RG, we have this flow to low energy, but if for some reason the initial conditions for the RG were constrained to an unusually small region of parameter space. So for example, many couplings were very naturally close to zero. Then even if we had a very large number of relevant operators, we could sit in the physics controlled by this, you know, this intermediate fixed point for a very long amount of RG time, for a wide range of scales. Because even though there are many, many ways for you to flow away, all the couplings of these different directions start out very, very small. And, you know, an alternative, a secondary intuition is that if really indeed you have this kind of infinite number of relevant perturbations, then you might expect that there would be a lot of entropy because you sort of have unutilized local degrees of freedom.
I understand the notion of a fixed point at RG, if you're treating some degrees of freedom classically and the other ones quantum mechanically, I'm not quite sure how that works. I mean, heuristically, I consider it to be, but I don't.
I don't see why there's necessarily an issue if I think about some imaginary time problem. Now, I agree that may not be related to the physical question that you're interested in. But at the level of an imaginary time problem, I think maybe or if I added some other degrees of freedom, right, in which these spins can be entangled with. So for example, you could imagine that there are, you know, some other layer of localized spins and they form strong singlets with the spins in this incoherent Lunger liquid. And so then if I include these extra degrees of freedom, I have a perfectly well-defined quantum system. It's just that the spins are somehow very tightly bound to some other degrees of freedom.
But then there's no entropy.
Well, there is then the entropy of just the spin incoherent, of just the fermions, of the electrons, is entanglement entropy between that electron, that spin incoherent electron liquid, and these other spins that are sitting, you know, above them or beside them or something like that. Right. So it's a question of what you mean by the entanglement, by the entropy.
So you formulate this, I assume
on chip formula,
the only fixed point is infinite number of perturbations.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, spin Hamiltonian zero.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Every perturbation is zero. But there is a fixed point.
Sounds like it's related to this kind of discrete quantum mechanics.
Yeah, I could see that.
So,
yeah.
Can one actually sit at zero temperature and then just study some J is small and just study behavior at time scale smaller than inverse J? I mean, or, you know, kind of, instead of thinking about this thermal, just think of it as kind of high frequency, high momentum.
Yes.
Is there any difference or?
I don't know.
Because that would be more like a conventional RG picture in terms of length scales and time scales.
Yeah, the answer is I don't know. I assume you could study it. I have not done it, so I don't know the answer. But I assume you could study it. But I think that this, you know, if you really have some bath or something like that, which is talking to your spins, then this picture is not so wrong. That would be the claim I would make.
If I'm thinking in some system like a glass, can I also think it's a kind of RG, this IR incomplete? Or, you know,
if you're thinking in terms of a glass,
yeah, the low energy for the possibilities, so is it different from a glass?
I think it is different from a glass, definitely. Whether the glass fits into this definition,
glass.
Yeah, whether this glass fits in the definition, I'm not sure. I have to think about it. That's a good question.
Right, perhaps you should maybe go for the simplest example, the most familiar example, would be an electron phonon system above the phonon.
That's no. I mean, I was going to mention that later, but yeah. I mean, but I agree. But it's, you know, it's sort of, yeah. I mostly agree with you, but I'm not sure it really fits exactly this definition, right? Because the phonons are still classical oscillators. It's not like they're something. They're not like they're completely incoherent. I mean, here the spin just has no structure at all. There, the degree of freedom still has some structure, right? So you could, in principle, distinguish those two situations.
Well, you have a quantum system. I don't know what incoherent means, but something like your lack of knowledge about it, perhaps. But I mean, we have a Schrodinger equation. We can start with the state, and we can evolve with time.
Well, I agree. Yeah. But if you have extra degrees of freedom, right? Then I can always forget about those extra degrees of freedom. Yeah, I could put in a heat bath, which is what I want to think about doing. Yeah. I completely agree that it would be very interesting to also study the closed dynamics of such a system. But I want to think about this heat bath situation. Okay. Yeah.
So it's interesting that the thermodynamics is nearly to be like a free friendly gas.
Yes.
Whereas dynamics becomes very complicated.
Yes.
But in the 1D Hubbard model, the infinite view, thermodynamics is immediately solved.
Yes.
Whereas the spins are hanging behind them. Confusing.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. So here's my tentative definition of IR incomplete. It's an RG fixed point with infinite number of relevant perturbations. It has extensive ground state entropy. But for some reason, for some dynamical reason, there's a natural suppression of these relevant couplings. You know, otherwise, it's extremely fine-tuned to sit here, and it's not a physically meaningful thing to think about. So this final point is extremely important.
Do require temperature is bigger than some kind of degeneracy energy scale.
Yes. Yeah, so just like in this spin incoherent situation, right? And I just to emphasize this third point is very, you know, very important. There's, you know, there are trivial systems. You can easily cook up systems which have extensive entropy. You know, for example, just take free fermions with a dispersion which is extremely flat, right? And then if you fix, you know, just estimate the entropy as log 2 times the volume of phase space, which is accessed by a finite temperature. You know, then if you fix T and take into infinity, you get extensive entropy, right? And you have infinite number of relevant perturbations. But this is completely trivial because there's no obvious way to suppress all these relevant operators. You know, why would only, you know, the gradient to the 100 be present? That just doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
It looks like a Landau
level. So if you have a reason, you know, why this can happen, that's great. But that's the key thing here is that there must be some, besides just the RG flow, there must be some physics which controls the initial conditions of that flow, which leads to the possibility of having this kind of degeneracy over a wide range of scales. Okay, so let me just now go back with our definition and look again at these two things. So this particular ensemble in the holographic setting has extensive classical entropy. And the spin incoherent electric liquid in this thermal ensemble also has extensive classical entropy. They have exponentially decaying spatial correlations. They have parallel decaying temporal correlations with this particular logarithmic correction, which matches exactly in both cases. It's 1 over square root of log. They have lots and lots of relevant perturbations. So here, you know, these fermionic operators, the dimension is a function of k. So any of these guys below, you know, the bounds will be relevant. So there's an infinite number of them. And similarly here, any spin interaction would resolve this degeneracy. You can look at other interesting things. You could look at, for example, Fredel oscillations. So it turns out that Fredel oscillations can also be heavily suppressed. These 2KF oscillations can be heavily suppressed in this state. And the same is true here, actually. If you look in this system as studied by Nabil and Tom, you find that there are 2KF oscillations, but they're very small compared to the natural scale of other correlation functions. They're suppressed by powers. They're suppressed by the large n limit. Okay, so what I like to say is that it looks to me like this IR incompleteness idea encompasses both these things and may give us a conceptual framework for trying to think about what the ADS2 looks like in higher dimensions. And, you know, also, can we extend, you know, this incoherent physics in a condensed matter setting to higher dimensions? Okay, so let me just mention in my remaining few minutes some possible examples. So one obvious thing to think about is DMFT, the large dimension limit, which is, again, a very weird problem. But in that case, you know, if you take this large D limit, you scale the bandwidth in a certain way, so you have a finite density of states, then you find that J goes like 1 over D. And what this leads to is a finite TC for spin ordering, because you have a growing number of neighbors. So even though J is getting small, the number of neighbors is getting big, and you have a finite TC in the limit of large D. But the spin velocity goes to zero. So it looks like these sound waves are becoming soft. The spin waves are becoming soft. But unfortunately, it looks like that the entropy is not doing anything too strange. So maybe if you can dress this system up in some way, you can get some more IR incomplete physics. This is not to say that DMFT is normal, but it doesn't appear to be as extreme as the ADS2 region. Okay, but this is still, okay, this is just I'm not sure about. Another possibility, which actually Subira studied extensively in the past, a proposal for this ADS2 region, is something like a Kondo lattice kind of model, where you have at short distances decoupled spins that are fluctuating, and then some conduction C, and then at long distances they couple together. And actually, there's renewed interest in the spin coherent physics by Fagan and Feet, in which they're talking about, you know, again, Kondo lattice models and using DMRG to study not just the thermal properties, but also time dependence. So this comes back to questions people have been raising. Another very natural place to look is potentially spin charge separated systems, because here you're just sort of decoupling spin and charge, so you could make the spin incoherent and the charge coherent, and that would still be perfectly reasonable. So anyways, there's a lot of possibilities. Let me just mention one interesting direction, which is to think about Wigner crystals in higher dimensions. So, you know, here's the triangular lattice that we believe electron gas in two dimensions forms if you're at sufficiently high RS bigger than about 37 or so. And it's true that even if you're at very low density, then you find again that these spin exchangers can be exponentially small. This uses just this theory of Thales developed back for helium-3. You can calculate it in Monte Carlo, and you find these exchanges are all exponentially small. Because even though you're moving in two dimensions, it's still hard to tunnel through these barriers to move your particles around. Right? So we again have a situation where the phonon scale is sort of normal or reasonable, but the spin scale is very small. And so if you could somehow melt the crystal or disorder the crystal without making the exchange big, then you might have, in higher dimensions, an example of this spin incoherent physics. So one idea would be to use vacancies, sort of like a super solid kind of picture, but it's not clear this will work because vacancies tend to short circuit the exchange paths. So when you have vacancies, it's easier for the particles to move around. And so locally, near the vacancies, the J's can become effectively larger. But anyway, so this is an interesting possibility. And let me finally just mention a few ideas that are more related directly to the gauge theory. So ultimately, you know, if we really say that the ADS2 region and this spin incoherent Luttinger liquid or this IR incomplete physics are the same thing, we might like to have a more microscopic model of what's going on in this ADS2 region. So one thing you can do, actually kind of interesting, is to play around with this spin incoherent physics a little bit, to replace the vector indice with a matrix index and to make them linearly dispersing and you can play various games and see if you can still get this degeneracy out. And in many cases, you can. And then you could even imagine trying to actually gauge this matrix degree of freedom. Right? So then what you'd want is somehow the gauge degree of freedom could provide the strong interactions as well as give you this entropy in this large N limit. And this is actually related to some work that Subir and collaborators did looking at particular models of fermions coupled to gauge fields in 1D. As I mentioned already, another very easy thing to do, kind of too easy, is, you know, you could try to do spin charge separation in higher dimensions. So for example, fractionalize your electron into a spinless charged fermion and a spinful chargeless boson. Then maybe the boson could form a crystal if you're at low density. maybe the exchange of these bosonic spins would be very small, but the charge could still be transported. Okay, so this is kind of a dumb example, but it maybe gives us some ground we can step on. Okay. I just want to note, you know, in these large engaged theories, like if we want to go beyond one dimension, you know, and we put a little finite density in there, we do indeed have very strong Coulomb fields. You could imagine things like crystallization occurring. So maybe the ADS2 in higher dimensions is actually a crystal. You just can't see it because it's 1 over n suppressed. I don't think that's necessarily right, but maybe it's a crystal or almost a crystal, and you could again have this kind of slow spin physics. Another interesting possibility, which is the last one I'll mention, is this idea of getting lost in Hilbert space. So with some collaborators at UBC, we studied a model of energy moving around where we specify local density of states. And what you find is if you specify a local density of states such that the density of states grows fast enough with energy. So it grows faster than e to the energy, so faster than this kind of so-called Hagedorn scaling in string theory. That what happens is instead of two energy degrees of freedom wanting to move apart, they want to just reconfigure locally because there's many more states available when the energies are sitting together, when the energy, you know, is localized. You have access to many more states at high energy than you do when the particles are apart. So you can actually suppress diffusion. And this is one way to understand how black holes are long-lived. So again, if you're suppressing motion of these particles, maybe you can get long-lived, you know, or slow exchange. Right? So these are just some crazy ideas. So with that, let me just recap and say this idea of higher incompleteness that I'm proposing is a very different type of emergence. It's not really a ground state property. It's some, you know, it's some very intermediate scale physics, but which nevertheless can control the physics over a wide range of scales because there is a natural suppression of these relevant couplings. Right? And there are interesting models that display this behavior, at least qualitatively. And I think the main, you know, questions in my mind are, you know, can we really push these higher dimensional models to something very concrete? You know, and do we really have the right conceptual features? You know, is this infinite number of relevant perturbations really what I want, or do I want something slightly different? Or is it important to have the entropy, you know, or what? So with that, let me say thank you.
So there's the ADS CMT approach for this non-Fermi equip.
Yeah.
So do you suggest, or maybe this is what really happened. So we basically have a black hole with a lot of entropy, but that's like a narrow band.
So.
And then this the scaling behavior one see actually is this this is a new kind of emerging scaling behavior.
Yes. So indeed, I mean, what's happening in at least the simplest, you know, the old, yeah, you know, Hong McGreevy version of this story is that you have some fermion which is coupled to this incoherent mess, this IR incomplete stuff, and you know, the fact that you have all these this massive degeneracy leads to, you know, very efficient relaxation of charge, for example, and leads to very anomalous fermionic properties,
okay,
you know, single particle properties. So that's sort of, you know, where this. That's kind of a connection there.
Well, one comment on Chang's question was, I mean, there are other versions of gravitational theory where this doesn't happen.
Yeah, of course.
But there's also another difference in that in the ADS2 story of MIT at all, this incoherent mass carries charge. It's really associated with the charge.
Yeah, but you know, if by charge you mean you like the electron number, then right, the, you know, the spin incoherent legend also carries charge.
You just mentioned something about transport quantities. In fact, transport quantities are not determined by the probe fermions, but by the charge in the horizon.
Yes, that's true.
And that's a somewhat different way in incoherent liquid where there was some other degree of freedom.
Yeah, in the case of that, you know, there may be an issue of large n, low t limits not commuting, where the probe fermions may ultimately they may ultimately control the transport, but they're sort of small. Depends on the details. But anyway, this is not a controlled statement, so let me not push it further.
I guess on the CMT side, the examples you described are where some part of the system is coherent and the other part isn't coherent.
Yes.
This is kind of zero problem to me.
Yes.
Seems like on the ADS side, coming back to my earlier question, like everything is local and interfered. Is that fair?
Well, I think what we're learning, or a picture of ADS stuff is actually that there is a very large amount of sort of order n squared amount of incoherent stuff. And then there are these few operators you explicitly deal with, these low dimension operators, which are somehow able to display potentially coherent physics. So it's some very small subset. So it's a system which sort of makes its own very large incoherent bath. And then there's a few small degrees of freedom, small number of degrees of freedom, which can display some more interesting, potentially coherent physics. I mean, just the operators that I mentioned. In other words, the black hole is, it's like saying if you have this large N-gauge theory, you know, all the quarks are just completely incoherent. But if you look at the mesons, you know, or the current, then there can be interesting dynamics for these operators. You see what I'm saying?
It seems like we have local physics for everything in this ADS too.
Yes, in this case you do. In this case you do. In other examples, you may have some mixture of the two.
So we can continue the questions of the